Info on events around the Charlotte region. You can sign up for WFAE's monthly e-newsletter. Go to WFAE.org and look for the sign-up button at the bottom of the homepage. This is a rebroadcast of a previous Charlotte Talk show so that they won't be taking any calls.
From 90.7 WFAE Charlotte, 90.3 WFHE Hickory, welcome to Charlotte Talks. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. It's been said for the ages that when we, the people, go back into our lineage, we find that most all of us come from someplace else. Well, as it turns out, so does much of what we eat, our food. Sweet potatoes, for example, top crop in North Carolina, but only after someone brought them over from someplace in Central or South America. Same story with peanuts. Okra originated in Africa. In fact, there's now so much history in horticulture that there's a new position that has, pun intended, cropped up. Horticultural historian, the father of whom was also the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson. Anyone who's visited Jefferson's Monticello estate in Virginia knows that he loved and was fascinated by gardening and growing, and not just the usual things, but the very unusual. Few people know more about the Thomas Jefferson Gardens than Peter Hatch. Hatch is former director of gardens and grounds at Monticello. Up until his retirement last year, he held that position for almost 35 years. Peter Hatch is also the author of A Rich Spot of Earth. Peter Hatch joins us from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Are you in Charlottesville, Peter?
I am indeed. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joining us here in the studio, Jeff Reeves, horticultural extension agent with the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Service and a master gardener himself, and just as excited as I am about talking to Peter Hatch. Jeff, good to see you.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Let me start by getting both of you to weigh in on that whole concept of horticulture history. Mm-hmm. My premise that even in the early days of this country, most of our food came from someplace else, too. Jeff, you start.
Well, there is an awful lot of history behind foods. Now, you know, even things as common as apples, they come from Afghanistan. They were brought over. You know, they made their way up into Europe and made it across the Atlantic Ocean. And were planted and took quite well. I mean, you know, even things as unusual as the honeybee, you know, that was brought over. The honeybee is not native to America, but it spread so fast, faster than people. You know, the Native Americans called them white man's flies because they knew if the bees were coming, the white people were not far behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are an awful lot of other instances like that. And Jefferson himself, I think, introduced quite a few things, particularly some of the things we take for granted today. And, of course, Peter can make a much better statement about that. So,
Peter, weigh in on horticultural history and that whole concept.
Well, I think that, I refer to Jefferson's garden as a true Ellis Island of new and unusual plants that came literally from around the world. And the study of the history of plants and the history of gardens is truly a fascinating one. It's there's been a real surge of interest in it over the last 30 or 40 years. And I actually began my career at Old Salem, where I was the first horticulturist in the mid-1970s in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And there I was responsible for restoring and taking care of and interpreting the historic Moravian gardens from the mid-18th century, where they had particularly precise records of the character of mostly food gardens.
Well, you were able, when you came, to Monticello, Jefferson was really good about keeping records, too. Well, he kept a lot. I don't know how good he was at it, but, you know, looking at the garden book and the farm book, he seemed rather meticulous to me.
Yeah, everyone out there can go online and Google Jefferson's garden book. It's 67 pages long. It's bound in leather, and it resides today at the Massachusetts Historical Society. And it's really a remarkable document that unveils Thomas Jefferson as this garden scientist, counting up how many Carolina beans would fill a quart jar, which would in turn plant so many feet of row in his garden.
Fact of the matter is, President Jefferson was pretty much fascinated by many of the earth sciences. Mm-hmm. He was somewhat of an amateur meteorologist.
Yeah, I think Jefferson is a singular figure in American history for the breadth of his intelligence and the wide range of his interest. And If you go to Monticello, it's truly an autobiographical statement that reflects him as someone interested in geology and paleontology and astronomy and meteorology. And it's truly a statement about who he was and the wide range of things that he was interested in, particularly gardening, I think.
And this whole concept of going to other places, and when you go to those other places, you would always bring back, he would always bring back, he would always ask people who were going to other places mm-hmm. to bring back seeds of fruits and vegetables that were grown in those native lands.
Yeah, Jefferson once wrote that the greatest service which can be rendered any country is to add a useful plant to its culture. And I often describe him as sort of a seedy missionary in the way he would receive and disseminate just these wide range of newly introduced plants into American gardens. And he believed plants could transform society. And, for example, when he was president, he had a blind tasting of salad oils in the president's house in Washington. And when people found the sesame oil preferable to all others, that set off this typically mad Jeffersonian obsession with growing sesame year in and year out in his vegetable garden at Monticello.
And where did he get the sesame?
I think sesame was around. It was being grown in a little bit around Charleston in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't necessarily an absolutely new plant, but sesame has wonderful African-American roots in this country. Mm-hmm. And a whole culture of sesame emerged in the low country of the Carolinas. Based on not just making oil, but for cooking and making cookies and breads and all sorts of different things.
One of the things that you mentioned, bring plants from other places, one of the less talked about aspects of the slave trade were all the plants and seeds and traditions that were brought to America and actually benefited quite a bit, like the sesame and some of the melons and things that were brought, the gourds that were brought. And those
were
peanuts. That's another one. There are a lot of different instances like that where they really contributed in so many ways in economically that way, in the foods they developed, because particularly in Charleston, which is where one of the bigger ports at early times, a lot of things came in and spread from there.
To include rice, for example, right?
Mm-hmm. Rice. In the low country, like Peter mentioned, you had indigo, the blue dye, indigo was grown, rice was grown. There were quite a few, over time, quite a few varieties of rice developed for the Carolina low country. And that was a really, really big moneymaker for that area. I think more for South Carolina low country than Wilmington, but even some in North Carolina.
In the Jefferson family manuscripts, there's a recipe for okra soup. And if you look at where those vegetables came from, you have butter beans and you have patty pan squashes that were grown by North American Indians when the first Europeans arrived. Mm-hmm. There were tomatoes and potatoes that came from this hemisphere but became popular early on in southern and northern Europe, respectively. And then okra brought the vegetable part of this dish together, and that's an African plant that was brought to the Caribbean and creolized by the French and brought to North America by slaves. And then this whole dish was brought together at Monticello by enslaved African-American chefs who'd been trained in the finest arts of French cuisine in the kitchens of both Paris and also the president's house in Washington. So what a rich amalgam of all these different traditions that went into the garden and then came into our kitchens and reflected sort of the diversity of who we are and began to define who we are as Southerners and as Americans.
Well, I think that's a real good point, Peter. Southerners, everything revolves around food. Everything. you get Southerners together, somebody's either, if not eating, they're going to be talking about what you have, Something will come up, a favorite dish will come up. And to me, this whole thing, the gardens, the kitchens, the relationships that develop around them, I call them a local food culture, and that's really what it's about. It's not just an isolated thing of, well, the cooking part of it's over here and the gardening part's over here. I mean, that's how I became a horticulturalist. I started cooking, and you can tell, a few folks at home can't tell this, but you can look at me and say, well, he pretty much likes to eat, that's how I got into it. I started cooking. I couldn't find what I wanted, so I started gardening vegetables, and that's why I started, one thing that leads to another, and all of a sudden here I am as a professional horticulturalist, but it's part of the food culture of my family.
And Jeff Reeves, I don't know if you've heard this or not, Peter Hatch, but Jeff Reeves refers to Thomas Jefferson
as the original foodie.
Yeah. Right. He was first in wine and first in gardening and first in food and in so many different ways.
Yeah.
And his legacy, I think, today is particularly profound as we look at this food to fork movement in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the times, if you will. I want to set the stage 200 years ago, a little over 200 years ago. President Jefferson had just served from 1801 to 1809. He had done a lot to form the country, not to mention form the University of Virginia up there in Charlottesville. He retires. Is it at that point that he really starts to concentrate on cultivating his gardens at Monticello, or was that something that moved him through his entire life? Peter?
Well, I think it moved him through his entire life. I mean, even as a young man at 23 years old at his boyhood home in Shadwell, he was counting up how many peas would fill a quart jar. So he was gardening at a really young age, which I think is extraordinary. He was gardening in his young 20s when most people don't do much for gardening. But it was in 1809, as he was anticipating his retirement from the presidency, that he began to really work toward developing the landscape of Monticello for his retirement years. And particularly the fruit and vegetable garden became really Jefferson's retirement garden. Between the ages of 67 and 83, for him to go out into this garden and sow peas or write down in his garden book when his salsify was being harvested was a real sort of defiance of age. And even at the age of 83, Jefferson read about giant cucumbers in a Cleveland, Ohio newspaper. And typical Jeffersonian fashion, he wrote to the governor of Ohio and asked him for seeds of these mighty cucumbers and sowed them in the garden, passed them around to his friends, measured how long each one was. And at one point, Jefferson had written that, although an old man, I am but a young gardener. And here he was very much at the age of 83 in his last years, very much fulfilling this role.
Well, speaking of giving instructions to those who were traveling to far places, and he was wanting those people to bring back seeds to him for his garden at Monticello. He did that with Lewis and Clark, did he not?
Oh, certainly. You know, a big part of the Lewis and Clark expedition was a botanical journey, a botanical search for new plants that, again, could transform society. And one of the fascinating aspects of it was the collection of Native American vegetables that was brought back by Meriwether Lewis and probably first grown by Thomas Jefferson in eastern North America at Monticello. And a lot of these vegetables were really particularly sophisticated. They're grown in the northern plains where the season was really short, where it was really dry in the summertime. And the Native Americans had developed these really sophisticated crops of corn, tobacco, beans and squashes. And again, a fascinating exchange of plants from the West that came to the East of cultivated plants that were economic plants that we eat.
Was that pretty much the fair, the vegetable fair at that time? It was limited to squash, beans, peas?
Well, among Native Americans, I think, you know, if you look
corn,
at the garden.
Corn, certainly.
Yeah, corn was certainly the staff of life then as it is today. But if you look at the gardens in Virginia around 1800, they were really kind of bereft of hot weather vegetables. Mm-hmm. They were relying on greens and root crops and cabbage family members, things that people were used to growing and consuming in the old world in Europe. And they're things that don't really grow well in our hot summers here in Virginia or in North Carolina. And so I think what Jefferson did that was really revolutionary was he assembled this collection of hot weather vegetables we take for granted today, from corn to tomatoes, from eggplants to peppers.
We are on a horticultural historic journey with Jeff Reeves from Monroe and Peter Hatch, former director of the Gardens and Grounds at Monticello in Virginia. We're back with more Charlotte Talks right after this.
Hope you're enjoying the programming. This is a rebroadcast of a prior Charlotte Talk shows. This is 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio. Where support this morning comes from WFAE members and James McElroy and Deal, a law firm helping individuals and businesses avoid problems, overcome obstacles, and minimize consequences for over 50 years. JMDLaw.com. From community festivals to holiday feasts, food brings people together. In WFAE's next public conversation, we'll explore the gathering power of food. This community forum will be held on Thursday evening, July 11th, at the Levine Museum of the New South. That's right across the street from the Chowdown Uptown Food Truck Festival. Get details and RSVP for the public conversation at WFAE.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Carol Burnett is best known as the star of her long-running TV variety show. In a new book, she describes a darker chapter in her life, the death of her daughter. Carol Burnett on her life and career.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. Our guests today include Peter Hatch, former director of gardens and grounds at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's estate in Virginia, author of the book A Rich Spot of Earth, Thomas Jefferson's Revolutionary Garden at Monticello. Jeff Reeves is horticultural extension agent with the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Service in Monroe. Do want to mention that you're bringing Peter Hatch to town for a conference on master gardening in Monroe.
That's right. It's Mastering the Garden Harvest. It's the state, North Carolina Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Association Conference, but it is open to the public. And we've got, a really great lineup of speakers. Of course, we're going to have Peter with us in the morning. And we'll also have Tony Avent, a plant explorer and nurseryman extraordinaire. He's going to be talking about soil. And then a charlatan, Jim Noble,
restaurateur,
King's Kitchen. He's going to talk to us about the impact of food on the needy. And then, we're going to have a lot of really good food. I'm looking at my good friend Jennifer Coots over here, and we've been doing the foodie thing lately, I'm just so excited about this. We've got some really, really good food coming up, local folks doing this whole thing. And then the entire afternoon, we'll have a lineup of speakers talking about different aspects. And then we're going to wrap it up with Cassie Parsons' group from Harvest Moon doing a farm-to-fork garden party.
Wow.
We've got a great garden out there.
More information is available on the North Carolina Master Gardeners Conference in Monroe on our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Paul and Charlotte just emailed us. Did Thomas Jefferson, Peter, this is for you, did Thomas Jefferson just try to grow various plants to see if they would grow in Virginia, or did he experiment with crossbreeding of plants that could be adapted to the warmer summer weather in Virginia?
Yeah, I don't think Jefferson really did much actual crossbreeding in the garden. I think he liked to play around with plants, and he would do things that are kind of forbidden today. He'd plant squashes and pumpkins and gourds and things that cross together. So they developed sort of new variations. And I think he was just sort of having fun rather than really seriously trying to develop something new himself at Monticello. I think he was, Jefferson was a cheerleader. Although he was an avid gardener, he was kind of a cheerleader for other people. He was a promoter. And so he was more getting things and growing them out rather than developing themselves. And plant breeding was really, really in its infancy in America around 1800, and particularly for vegetables. It was like 50, 60, 70 years later that people really began hybridizing and developing and improving vegetable crops within each species.
Along those same lines, if you don't mind, is there evidence that some plants he planted just did not work in Virginia? Pineapple comes to mind, for example.
Olive trees is a great example.
Oh, yeah, really?
Jefferson.
Okay. Now, I think I remember reading that he really was fascinated by olives and olive oil.
Right. He described the olive tree as a manna from heaven. And, Jefferson once wrote that if he failed 99 times out of 100, that one success was worth those 99 failures. And if you look closely at this garden book, you'll see the repetition of the word failed, sometimes crosses through his garden diary. And he had almost a holistic view of the gardening process. He said that in gardening, it's the failure of one thing that is repaired by the success of another. A wonderful mantra, not just for gardening, but for a lot of other things as well. So he was trying things, he was experimenting. He liked to eat, he was primarily a vegetarian. He said he ate meat only as a condiment to his meals.
Right. Mm.
Yeah, and so he liked to eat vegetables, and he liked to plant vegetables. And tellingly, there's very few references in Jefferson's garden book to how he took care of his gardens in terms of staking or fertilizing. It's all about setting things out and harvesting them for the table.
One of the things that I was interested in, and the more I've learned about his horticultural life, is he seemed to be really, and it probably comes from his public life, is that he was really an economic development person for agriculture. You know, there was one period of time, and I think it may have been in his garden book. Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, but he recorded everything that was in the Washington farmers markets, you know, and was always giving stuff to them. The olive trees were one crop he tried to promote, I think. And so, Peter, am I on the right track here?
Yeah, this chart, when he was president of the United States over the 8 years of his two terms, he kept a chart of the first and last appearance of 37 different vegetables in the farmer's market in Washington, D.C. And according to one of his friends, he went around to foreign embassies, and they would vie with each other to give him the most unusual type of vegetable. And Jefferson, in turn, would get the seeds of these vegetables and pass them out to local gardeners with directions on how to grow them. And then he ordered his French maitre d', who did the shopping, to pay the highest prices for the prettiest cauliflower or the earliest tomato that came into the market. So, you know, Jefferson really set this amazing legacy for encouraging local food and the farm-to-table movement.
Yeah, well, that's a very important thing that is not really talked about when in this whole thing about local food or food activism, however you want to call it, but the economic aspects of this. You know, the North Carolina State and the NCDA, we've gotten together and created this group. It's the 10% campaign. You know, if the people in North Carolina spent $1.05 per person per day on local food, that would pump $3.5 billion, and that is with a B, into the local economies of the state.
Eating locally grown.
Yes, yes. $1.05 per person per day. That ain't much. They have a tremendous impact. You know, and there's a lot of folks out there. I talk to people every day, you know, that especially young people, and this is an important thing, you know, that we have young people getting into farming in all aspects, because many of the farmers, I mean, I'm in my mid-50s, you know, many of the farmers are my age or older, you know, and some of them, like my kids, are not really interested all that much in the horticultural aspects or growing food or anything, and many of the other farmers have the same situation. So having the new folks come in, as you said, need to encourage young people in another context, that's really what we need to do. And to be able to make a living, and I'm not talking about being immensely wealthy, I'm talking about just a standard middle-class living. You know, and the best way to do that, spend your money with local folks. You know, go to local farmers markets. Go to the local restaurants that buy and sell local food. You know, and I think it's a small thing. It's many times local food has gotten this cachet of it's for wealthy folks or it's too expensive, and that's just not the case. You know, so many places you can go and eat and get a fantastic meal for no more than you would if you went to, you know, a regular restaurant anyway. So there's a lot of aspects here. And Jefferson, I think, was one of the forefront of all that.
He would have really appreciated this whole concept about the new cropping up, if you will, of farmers markets all over mm-hmm. the state of North Carolina mm-hmm. and all over mm-hmm. everywhere. Right, Peter?
Oh, I think for sure. And just as a side note, I contribute a lot to the North Carolina economy every time I go to the beach. And I always stop at roadside stands and buy lots of butter beans and lots of field peas, two great products of eastern North Carolina that mm-hmm. I always return home with to Virginia with.
Let's go over a list, if you will, of the vegetables that Thomas Jefferson ended up introducing to this country and to the rest of us that, you know, are still here today.
Yeah, it's tough to really prove that Jefferson was the first person to grow any type of vegetable. One of the best arguments or the best cases could perhaps be made for the modest rutabaga. Jefferson may have been the first American to grow rutabagas.
Yeah,
so I like to refer to him as the third president of the United States and the author of the Declaration of Independence, and Thomas Jefferson, rutabaga man. But the things that were unusual were these newly introduced crops from mostly our part of the world, or at least in the South, tomatoes and okra and peanuts and sweet potatoes and eggplants and peppers and this whole range of things that do well in our gardens in the middle of the hot summer. And like I said, most gardens in Virginia particularly were bare of vegetables in the middle of the summertime. And Jefferson's adaptation of a lot of these new things was really kind of extraordinary.
Well, let me ask you a question. Now, there is this, I don't know whether they call it an urban legend because it's so old, this thing of that Jefferson was the first one to actually was to promote tomato eating amongst the Europeans, I'll say. And nobody would eat one because they all thought it, because it's a member of the nightshade family, they thought it was poison. So he goes to the courthouse and he eats a tomato on the steps. And no, I didn't die, so you can eat one too.
Yeah. The story happened in Lynchburg, or the reputed story, but there's a lot of fake lore about Jefferson and the introduction of this and the introduction of that. And the tomato story is undeniably exaggerated to a great extent. The tomato was slow in being adapted by American gardeners. It was found by the Spanish in Central America. And when brought to Europe in the early 1500s, it really received a lot of attention. It was almost too sexy for its own good. It's really the sensual plant with these sprawling, stinky vines and this lap-wetting, large red fruit. And so people were a little bit awed by it, and they ultimately gave it a lot of unpleasant associations with other members of the nightshade family. And if you read early writers in Northern Europe particularly, they'd talk about how the tomato was something that was grown in Mediterranean countries by the Spanish and the French. But in London, they'd say, well, only no civilized man would try these things. It's something associated with the South. So there's a sort of nativism associated with tomatoes, as well as this sort of fear of almost its sensuality. And it was slow to being brought into American gardens, but they were growing it in Williamsburg in the 1750s, a Portuguese physician, and Jefferson was one of the first people to really adapt it generally as a culinary vegetable. And there's some 17 recipes in the Jefferson family manuscripts devoted to making tomato ketchup and tomato omelets and gazpacho and a variety of other things.
A gazpacho. Mm-hmm. A chilled tomato soup, chilled tomato vegetable soup. Thomas Jefferson.
Right. Oh, my goodness.
Right. Well, we've been talking about him as a horticulturist, but, he was a real epicure. I mean, Peter can speak to this more than I can, but I'm amazed, he already mentioned about the French-trained chefs. He had, I'm trying to remember at one point, I don't know if this is when he was in the White House or not, that he offered freedom to one of his slaves if he would go train with this particular chef. When you do that, and you learn all this French cooking from this particular chef, come back to Monticello, and I'll grant you your freedom.
Yeah, well, Jeff, I think that's a fairly true story. When he was president, he kept a master plan of meals that he served in the president's house. It was called the president's house until the British burned it down. It was rebuilt, and it became the White House. And these recipes were written down in French, and they were taken down verbatim probably from his French chef. But among the recipes was one for what we call today French fries. Mm-hmm. And I say there's a lot of fake lore about Jefferson, but a really good case could be made that by way of his French chef, he was the first American to serve what we call today French fries.
Dropping potatoes into hot oil.
Yeah,
right. Thinly cut potatoes, for sure.
So those of us that walk around a little more amply endowed than other folks.
It's because of the
Thomas
French
Jefferson,
fries.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of those French fries. And, we alluded a few moments ago to him instructing people, asking people who are going to faraway places to come back with a bag full of seeds mm-hmm. of whatever vegetables. Mm-hmm. He did that himself, did he not?
Yeah, there's a wonderful story about how Jefferson, when he was serving as minister to France, he went on travels throughout Southern Europe. It was mostly wine travels in some ways, but there was a dry land rice that was grown in northern Italy that he was particularly fascinated with, and there were laws in this region of northern Italy about not taking the seed out of its particular region because they were so it was treasured so highly, and they didn't want it distributed around other places. And there's a story about how Jefferson, you know, smuggled this rice out of Italy back into the United States in the pockets of his coat under the penalty of death, really, for smuggling this rice away. And he looked at, again, plants as a vehicle for social change, and he hoped to introduce this dry land rice into the Carolinas and move low country Carolina rice growers out of their malarial-ridden swamps to higher, healthier Piedmont soils. So, again, there was this... there was a social and economic basis for his interest in bringing in new plants like the dry land rice.
Well, we actually have a rice producer in mid-North Carolina over in Chatham County. There's some folks growing dry land rice up there, so that's part of Jefferson's legacy.
Well, speaking of Jefferson and his travels, let's go to the phone lines. Lawrence and Charlotte, you have a question about that.
Well, I have a question and a comment. The question is, since Jefferson, you know, was very familiar with French culture, did he actually train or experience any of the French cultivation techniques or bring them back? You know, the French had the orangery and the cloches. And also a comment, if he were primarily a vegetarian, that would kind of reinforce the knowledge that whole foods, plant-based nutrition actually is the most beneficial for a long life and good health.
Well, Jefferson lived a long time, and I'm not sure you can actually say that it was the reliance on vegetables that did it, but I'm sure it was a positive thing. He lived well into his 80s, and he was still gardening at the age of 81 and 82 at Monticello. So, yeah, he loved vegetables, and they were a principal part of his diet. There's no question about that. And
he said meat was only cultivation techniques.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, one of the things I argue about in my book is that Jefferson's Monticello garden was sort of an American garden in being kind of casual.
Right.
He'd seen really fancy European kitchen gardens that were heavily cultivated with huge staffs of gardeners. And Jefferson's garden was the real genius of it is its microclimate. It's carved out of the southern hillside. It's 1,000 feet long. It traps the sun. It enables Jefferson to really extend the growing season into the winter months, but also to successfully cultivate a lot of these hot weather vegetables.
Did he use any hotbeds or greenhouses or anything as starters?
The essential art of a European or even an American garden around 1800 was the use of what are called hotbeds, and that was the use of unfermented manure that was put in the base of a cold frame, and as it ferments, it heats up the soil and enables gardeners to harvest asparagus in December and bring melons to the table early in the springtime. And this was a common technique, and it was adapted by some American gardeners, but there's no reference to Jefferson using hotbeds. In some ways, this microclimate at Monticello was one big hotbed, enabled him really to do a lot of the things that artificial means would offer to other gardeners. This microclimate, the south-facing slope.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Lawrence, thanks so much for that phone call. Excellent questions. And a pitch for your book, Peter, A Rich Spot of Earth, Thomas Jefferson's Revolutionary Garden at Monticello. And our discussion with Peter Hatch, as well as Jeff Reeves from the Horticultural Extension Agent with the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Service. We'll continue on Charlotte Talks right after this.
Thanks for sharing your Friday morning with us. You're listening to this rebroadcast show of Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, your source for in-depth news. And support this morning comes from WFAE members and Invest Collegiate, Charlotte's new public college preparatory charter school, opening this month near Uptown, embracing each child's potential and inspiring academic success. InvestCollegiate.org. The weather forecast for the Charlotte area today, showers likely, chance of thunderstorms this afternoon with a high around 85 degrees. Tonight, cloudy, more rain in the forecast and a low in the upper 60s. And for tomorrow, more rain, possible thunderstorms, humid with a high near 85 degrees and Tomorrow night, a low expected near 70 with more rain in the forecast.
When people get together for a conversation or a celebration, there's always food involved, right? Well, WFAE's next public conversation explores the gathering power of food. Join a local panel of food enthusiasts at this free community forum Thursday evening, July 11th at the Levine Museum of the New South. And the Chowdown Uptown Food Truck Festival is right across the street. RSVP for the public conversation at WFAE.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. Our guests today include Peter Hatch, former director of Gardens and Grounds at Monticello, and author of the book A Rich Spot of Earth, Thomas Jefferson's Revolutionary Garden at Monticello. Jeff Reeves is with us as well. He's the Horticultural Extension Agent with the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Service. We were talking before the break, Peter, you were talking a little bit about the fact that Jefferson did have, for fertilizing purposes, a mound of manure always available at Monticello.
Well, yeah, I think that's pretty much true. One year, Jefferson got a letter from his daughter, Martha, and Jefferson at the time was in Philadelphia serving as Secretary of State, and Martha was planting the garden, and she wrote to her father and complained about the insects ravaging her cabbage plants as fast as she could set them out into the garden. And so Jefferson responded and said, well, the problem with the plants is not the insects themselves, is the fact that the soil's so bad. Mm. And he said the two of them that winter would cover the entire garden with a heavy coating of manure. And he said when plants are growing in rich soil, they will in turn, in Jefferson's words, bid defiance to all sorts of droughts and diseases and insects.
I mean, in other words, the stronger the plant, the more likely it could withstand an assault from mm-hmm. the environment as well as the pest in the environment.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And the real way to do that was by improving the character of the soil. So, Jefferson was obviously carrying the banner of what we call today the organic gardening movement. He didn't have too many alternatives at the time, but reflects this sort of balanced view of nature versus the garden. Jefferson believed in working with the natural world, that there was no great tension between wild nature and the assaults that it puts on a garden and the garden itself. And again, reflects sort of this holistic view of the gardening process, but also a nice lesson. Certainly, a heavy coating of manure is a great step toward having a healthy, strong, viable garden.
One of the things that I teach in the class is feed the soil, let the soil feed the plant, and that makes for a healthier plant, and healthy plants make healthy people. Mm. Part of that food culture goes back to that. And growing our own, how much more local and how much more fresh can you get by having it in your backyard or in a container close by? And I think that's one thing that I was really fascinated by in this whole garden thing, of the way, while he may have spent most of his time in his own garden, he really was a big part of the food culture,
In that area of Charlottesville, Virginia.
Yes, and everybody talks about the first tomato of the season. His big thing, I think, was the first garden peas of the season. Right, Peter?
That's correct. He had contests with his neighbors to see who could bring the first English pea to table in the springtime, the winner hosting the losers over for a community supper that included a feast on the winning teaspoon or dish of peas. And, the family story is that Jefferson never won the contest except for one year, and he had a neighbor who was probably his best friend outside the world of politics. His name was George Divers, and Mr. Divers regarded himself as the king of the pea contest. And when Jefferson actually brought the first pea to table, he refused to divulge the fact to his best friend in fear of rocking the pride of Mr. Divers. Mm. And another lesson is with Mr. Divers and Jefferson was that Jefferson would always share things. Seeds that he brought back from Europe or special plants, he often would share them with Divers. And Divers was a much better gardener than Jefferson. And when Jefferson would kill something at Monticello or lose the seed, he could always go back to Divers and get replacement plants. He was a great safety net for the gardens. But a real lesson for all gardeners is to share what you have, because it can come back and further your own interest later on in your own garden.
Well, let's get back just a moment, if we can, back to the whole concept about organic gardening. Did Thomas Jefferson and the gardeners of his day use pesticides?
Yeah, well, pesticide is anything that kills an insect, and it can have natural occurring pesticides. Jefferson doesn't talk much about how he took care of plants. One of his friends had a marvelous technique for ridding his peach trees of borers, peach tree borers, a horrible problem with peaches, by wrapping tobacco leaves around the trunks of peaches. So people used the pesticides, but they were all natural occurring, whether it's lime or ashes from the stove or tobacco dust. Gardeners have always been creative in utilizing whatever materials are at hand. But Jefferson really talked about, you know, using any kind of pest control. And he did garden in certainly an age of innocence, in the sense that a lot of our worst pests have been more recently introduced from other parts of the world and only became problems once they got here.
One of the things that I would say about that is we tend to try to grow varieties maybe that aren't really suited for here. And there are good reasons to do that. I'm going to use, for instance, my love of the Brandywine tomato. That is a great tomato. It comes in lots of different colors and grown all over. It likes cooler weather than we have here and has very little disease resistance. And so when I plant that, I realize, okay, this is going to be a little more difficult for me to do. And there may have been some of that, certainly would have been in Jefferson's case, because he was trying to do these things.
He was experimenting with everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, when we try to go outside the box, outside the garden bed in this case, you know, we have to realize, and one of the simplest things to do for a healthier garden is try to pick varieties that are suitable. And there are a lot of old varieties that are suitable for here. I'll use this particular variety of apple, the Lacey apple. You know, was grown in Union County, and the only place you can find, well, there may be a few more places today because my friend Lee Calhoun propagated this particular one, but he found it in Union County, North Carolina, and at the time, I think it was in the mid-1980s when he rediscovered it, and I say that, and it sounds a little arrogant because there were plenty of people in Union County who knew about it. He started propagating this apple, and it was very well suited for this area. And, you know, we've lost a lot of apples and other plants that were the same thing. You know, the local apples all went away, and now, you know, you can only get Red Delicious, you know, nice apple, but not well suited for our humid climate.
Yeah, one of the problems of this being an Ellis Island of new and introduced plants from all over the world is that they're not naturally suited to our part of the world or our environment. And there's very few native plants that have become economic plants. There's blackberries and strawberries and grapes. But a real kind of issue is the fact that most of our economic plants, the things that we eat, really come from other parts of the world.
Along these lines, though, when he's talking, a point of personal privilege real quick. What did Jefferson do, and what can I do about the deer and the rabbit?
Yeah, gosh, I think I think you have to put up. The first thing I did when I started I have my own garden now. I moved to a new house in July, and the first thing I did was put up a 8-foot high deer fence about around where my vegetable garden is going to be. So
okay.
I think you know, a fence is really the best solution for deer. At Monticello, for years we had and still do we have dogs that we put out at night. Beagles, and they have collars, and we have invisible fence around our flower garden, invisible fence around the vegetable garden. At night, these dogs go out and patrol the gardens, at least in one way or another. And later on in the summer, when things get dry and our gardens are irrigated, one can see a Lucy going after some deer at one end of the 1,000-foot garden and deer sneaking in the other end 1,000 feet down, and Lucy turning around scampering after them. So there's been it's been a mixed results, but that's been one solution for a deer at least at Monticello.
All right, fantastic. Let's go back to the phone lines. Christina and Charlotte, you've been holding for a while. Christina, good morning to you.
Good morning. I just have to say you blew my mind a bit with the honeybee comment because I had no idea, and my question is related to that. I'm aware that the Native Americans were growing cucurbits for quite a while. before the Europeans came over growing, like, you know, the Three Sisters, the pumpkins, and the squash. But being somebody who has grown squash for a few years, which I think probably most Southerners have, I know that when bees aren't around, the squash tend to die. I mean, you don't get the squash if they're not pollinated by the bees. So I guess my question is, how on earth were they able to grow squash if they didn't have bees as pollinators?
Well, actually, they had pollinators. There were plenty of pollinators around. You know, there are some native bees. It's just the honeybee was brought over with the Europeans. But there are also a lot of other types of pollinators. And, you know, when the pollen gets really heavy, there may be a little bit of air pollination, but the other pollinators, I think, would take up the slack. But your point's well taken about the value of the honeybee. You know, the interesting thing about squash and all the different cucurbits like that is the male flowers are all much larger and showier, which, you know, I guess that's typical of males anyway. And, you know, they're there to, you know, attract whatever the pollinators are. So, you know, nature provides for a lot of that as well. That's a good question, though.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Christina. Peter, we've got to get to your restoration project, your recreation, your research that got Monticello back to where it was in Jefferson's day. And this was a project that you started about 35 years ago?
That's right. In 1977, our board at Monticello made a real commitment to putting back Jefferson's landscape as it existed during his retirement years at Monticello. And I was hired as a horticulturist to be part, really, of a team that was involved in a lot of different projects, including the fruit and vegetable garden. And I mentioned archaeology earlier, and we have these wonderful notes and documents from Jefferson, but he changed his mind a lot, and his ideas evolved, and a lot of things he talked about doing, he never actually did. And so we used archaeological techniques to sort of uncover and decipher this documentation. And I mentioned how we found the stains of Jefferson's original fruit trees. And so we were able to put the fruit trees back in the actual place where Jefferson had them 200 years ago.
Along those lines, Carrie emailed in to us and asked, does Monticello have any descendants from the heirloom plants from Jefferson's garden? Are the gardens authentic in the sense that heirloom seeds were used, for example?
Yeah, we have one of the things we've prided ourselves on is our collection of historic and Jefferson-era varieties, and our fruit collection is really admirable in terms of the old apples that Jefferson grew and even some of the peaches and cherries and pears. And the vegetables are a lot more complex, but we feature a lot of Jefferson actual varieties, from the tennis ball lettuce to the brown Dutch lettuce, from the tree onion to the Carolina lima bean, from the prickly seeded spinach to the pineapple melon. And the gardens serve as sort of a seed bank where we grow these plants and let them go to seed, and then we collect the seed and we actually process it and sell it to as many people as possible. And on our website at www.monticello.org, we have the Center for Historic Plants, where we have seeds that are offered in mail order. We really distribute some 100,000 packets of seed every year around the world. The best way of saving things is by giving them away to as many people as possible. So that's been an essential part of our program. And a lot of these things have been brought in. There's some things that have grown wild at Monticello that have escaped from Jefferson Gardens, from the Florentine tulip, a wild or species form of tulip, to blackberry lilies, from old hollyhocks to tasseled hyacinths that we can collect, and we're pretty confident actually descended from Jefferson plants at Monticello itself.
One of the interesting things today is there are a lot of heirloom plants coming back and a lot of seed swapping going on, shades of Thomas Jefferson, obviously. And, you know, the email was from somebody in Charlotte, if I recall correctly. You know, in Charlotte, there's an awful lot of places and ways to get heirloom seeds. You know, one thing is talk to your neighbors, particularly if it's an older neighbor that's been in Charlotte for a while. I'm going to bet if they're gardening any at all, well, I got these seeds that Grandma gave me, and, you know, and sometimes it may even be a plant. I've got plants, peony plants, that I got from my grandmother, and she got her starts from her grandmother, and now they're in the teaching garden at the Union County Ag Center. So it's one of those things, the pass-along plant concept. And there are a lot of different instances, you know, and even So True Seeds and some of the other local seed companies, and I say local, North Carolina-based, have local heirloom seeds as well. So they're a lot more widely available than they used to be.
Back to the restoration of the gardens at Monticello, Peter, did you plant where Jefferson planted?
Right. And, you know, the restoration of the garden took place after many years of archaeology and began in the early 1980s and involved the 400-tree fruit orchard and two vineyards and berry squares and the 1,000-foot-long vegetable garden terrace and a stone wall that supported that terrace, also 1,000 feet long, and Jefferson's garden pavilion or temple at the halfway point of the garden itself. So all this was restored in the early 1980s, and it was considered at the time the most accurate garden restoration of its kind because of this use of archaeology, plus Jefferson's really meticulous notes on planting plans and the character of plants themselves.
Quite frankly, we can still learn so much from the way that Thomas Jefferson mm-hmm. planted a garden over 200 years ago.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of great lessons that Jefferson gives gardeners today. One of them was that he was really really into successive plantings. He wouldn't just plant lettuce once. He'd plant it. He actually published a garden guide in a national periodical. And one of his words of advice was to sow a thimble full of lettuce every Monday morning from February 1st until September 1st.
Good advice.
A remarkable statement that the first thing you do every Monday morning is you get up and you go out and you sow your thimble full of lettuce. And it's a little impractical in our southern climate in the heat of the summertime to grow lettuce all summer, but it's still a nice lesson of that successive plantings to have continued harvest through the year.
Yep.
Peter Hatch, former director of Gardens and Grounds at Monticello, author of the book, A Rich